We are keeping democracy alive, and boy, what a struggle it is. Maybe a struggle, but we have to do it. As politicians make as much noise as they can about the terrifying opioid epidemic sweeping America, there have been some truly shocking twists and turns lately. Scandals are mounting against government-protected and supported pushers of addictive opioids. The families of dozens of U.S. troops killed or injured during the war in Iraq have also just filed a federal lawsuit against several of the biggest, most well-known of the pharmaceutical industry, including GE Healthcare, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and Roche Holdings. The picture started to emerge when President Trump's appointment to head the Federal Drug Agency was revealed as a high-powered lobbyist for the very makers and sellers of some of the most addictive and dangerous drugs infecting our young people. Of course, after the revelation, the appointee withdrew his name, but it seems like we may be just beginning to learn how deep and wide is the influence of these corporate drug pushers. We're starting to learn of the incredible damage they have caused on so many American lives, and it seems perhaps actually cost the lives of some Americans fighting against the enemy in Iraq. Our guest today wrote an article in USA Today on October 17th titled "Iraq War Victims Alleged Pharmaceutical Companies Bribery Led to U.S. Troop Deaths." Amar Murhani is a Chicago-based correspondent for USA Today. Previously, he was a White House and Baghdad correspondent for USA Today. Thank you so much for being with us today on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Hey, thanks for your interest in this topic.
Well, it is. It's amazing how much stuff is going on. And I think more people find out about it, the more interest it may be. Thank you for doing the research and writing the article. As you write, in the aftermath of the 2003 invasion, Iraq's healthcare spending surged and the health ministry's budget ballooned from $16 million during Saddam Hussein's final year in power to about $1 billion in 2004. So from $16 million to $1 billion. That's a rather big jump. History has shown that there's never a lack of money to be made from wars. According to the allegations in the lawsuit, how did this surge in spending affect some of the biggest names in the pharmaceutical industry?
Right. So, with the amount of money, people were just ready to get in there. You know, this was such a great market. And it was a really open market. So you saw these Western companies, and U.S. companies, and some of these are European-based. And in the case of GE Healthcare, it's not just pharmaceuticals. These are medical supply companies as well. And so they were looking to break in to the market, and they were going to do, and as the lawsuit alleges, they were ready to do whatever needed to be done to get in, and part of it, the lawsuit alleges, is they were willing to pay kickbacks, and these kickbacks were billed as commissions or free goods that amounted to as much as 20% of the value of the contract, and that would get its way to ministry officials, and then in turn, the ministry, which around 2005 came in control of loyalists to Muqtada al-Sadr, anti-American cleric, and the spiritual leader of the Mahdi army. They were in turn using those kickbacks to help fund this militia that was fighting Americans.
Absolutely amazing. It's almost beyond belief. There's so much stuff these days with the Trump administration. It's really through the looking glass. So we're talking about corruption that is...
And this goes way back before the Trump administration. This is, you know, we're talking like 2005 to 2008.
Oh, true.
In the midst of the Bush administration.
Ah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. But, you know, it goes on, and where there's money to be made. So it seems like the plaintiffs in this case... Well, first off, who are the plaintiffs in this case? And then we'll look into what they're charging.
Sure. So these are the families of people, of troops, U.S. troops, who were died or injured in Iraq, as well as some of the survivors who were injured by attacks that are attributed to the Mehdi Army.
Uh-huh. So these transactions, through them, allegedly, the companies aided and abetted the militants, violating the U.S. Anti-Terrorism Act. Did these companies knowingly finance the anti-American Mahdi army, which may have killed Americans? Do you think they knew it?
You know, I don't. We have to wait for discovery
right.
To see how hard the information is. But the attorneys who brought the lawsuit, they definitely think that they. They have it. You know, they're basing these allegations on information that they collected from confidential sources that knew of, directly of the kickbacks, public and non-public reports, contracts, emails, the plethora of diplomatic and military cables that were published by WikiLeaks, Iraqi market data, regulatory statements.
Oh.
Public statements and some reports that came out from U.S. and Iraqi government officials, press reports about concerns that the U.S. at the time had about the Mehdi Army and Southern loyalists basically using the health ministry as its piggy bank. so there's a lot there.
Yeah. Now, we mentioned that they may have been violating the U.S. Anti-Terrorism Act. I'm not real familiar with what's in there. What might they have done that would have violated the U.S. Anti-Terrorism Act? I don't...
Well, you know, and so the Anti-Terrorism Act was put in place basically to make sure that you, if you're an American or international, multinational company, that you have a... responsibility to make sure that your business is not benefiting a terrorist organization or an organization that may be doing harm to American people or definitely U.S. troops.
Yeah, imagine that, being against such a thing. Oh, my goodness. You know, there's always war profiteers, but, whoa, yeah, it's generally, you know, it's people... Interest making money from the war from our side, not on the other side. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Amer Moudhani. He's a Chicago-based correspondent for USA Today, former White House and Baghdad correspondent for USA Today. We're discussing an article he wrote called Iraq War Victims Allege Pharmaceutical Companies Bribery Led to U.S. Troop Deaths. Just incredible. Please explain this from your article. The lawsuit claimed that defendants did not intend for the free goods, in quotes, provided to Kadima. So defendants did not intend for the free goods provided to Kadima, the health ministry's pharmaceutical importing agency, to serve any legitimate, charitable, or medicinal purpose. No rational company would have viewed the Ministry of Health as a suitable object for charity.
Right.
Say more about that. That's pretty strong.
So that goes back to sort of what people knew, you know, contemporaneously at the time of what was going on at the health ministry and sort of the concerns that this was being used as a piggy bank for the Southern and funding the Mehdi Army. Everybody knew about it. There was a report from the U.S. Embassy that leaked at the time that basically said, and I'll read you the quote, that it was operating, that the ministry was operating quote, as a pharmaceutical diversion scheme, and their concerns of the ministry being, quote, openly under the control of the Mehdi army. A lot of companies, and including journalism organizations, you know, we also subscribe when we're in these tough spots, security and intelligence providers that are also providing you guidance. When I was living in Baghdad, I had a security provider that would provide me with a weekly report of things that were being heard just for my own safety. In the same way, these big multinational companies are getting a lot of security information. Several of these companies were subscribing to this very well-known global intelligence company called Stratfor that was providing them with information. And they noted, you know, even earlier than that U.S. Embassy Baghdad report came out, that there was concerns. You know, they were talking about things that the American media wasn't talking about, with the arrest of who was then the deputy health minister, who was accused of selling health services and equipment for millions of dollars that he had allegedly funneled to these militias.
Hmm. I don't know how people can live with themselves, but I guess it's about money. It's just what it is. It's an anarchist, chaotic situation, a lot of money flowing around. So do we know approximately how many Americans may have been killed or injured by this Mahdi army, which is
right.
alleged to have been supported by the American and British pharmaceutical industry? Do we know?
I think the Mahdi army, it's somewhere around 200, it might just below 200 U.S. service members are attributed to have been killed by incidents that they were responsible for, and hundreds of others were injured.
And so how, these families, so they represent at least some of these 200?
Yeah, it's dozens. You know, it isn't right. That have signed on to this lawsuit. These law firms are not representing every soldier who is affected.
Well, it takes a lot of money to hire these powerful Washington lobby firms. I mean, lawyers, let's face it. So they must feel like they have a pretty good case. Now, of course, many Americans remember the name Muqtada al-Sadr. Who was he? Tell us about his political power and his perhaps his role in the alleged corruption. Were his backers using the Ministry of Health to bankroll the mighty army? His backers, Muqtada al-Sadr.
So he was one of the most troublesome and frankly intriguing characters of the early U.S. occupation, and continues to be just sort of an intriguing figure in Iraqi politics. So if you go back to the start of the war in 2003, he was in his mid to late 20s at the time, and weeks after the invasion, the U.S. tried to bring this moderate Shiite cleric named Abdul-Majid al-Kuwi into the holy city in the hopes that, you know, this could be their connection to the majority Shiite community as the government rebuilds. Kuwi arrives, and he's assassinated, stabbed by a lieutenant of Sadr. And just around the same time as the Mahdi army, this militia appears, and it's making its way into the Shiite slums of Baghdad that had been known as Saddam City, and it gets renamed as
Sadr City. Yeah.
And it's not named after Muqtada. It's named after his father. He was born into this famed and really well-respected family of Shiite scholars. His father was Grand Ayatollah, Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr, and he was very influential. And his father and two of his brothers were assassinated by Saddam in the late 90s.
Uh-huh.
And Muqtada went into hiding in Iran until the U.S. invasion. But he was sort of dismissed as this kid cleric. You know, I remember him being sort of dismissed by some as the Nintendo cleric or the Atari cleric, because he was just, you know, this 20-something kid, and even early on after the assassination of Cui, he was seen more as a street thug than an influencer. But he was a thorn in the U.S. side. You know, as if you remember back, you know, the early on, so much of the focus early on was first on the Al-Qaeda influence and Sunni populations west of Baghdad and the uprising that began in Fallujah. And he used that moment as Al-Qaeda was trying to make its headway to agitate in Baghdad. And he had a huge amount of influence in the sectarian violence that tore apart Iraq sort of in that 2006 to 2008 era.
All right, I know that.
But these days, you know, he emerged then also as this great political player. And, you know, the May the Army has even been renamed now. It has a new name in Arabic. It's Saraya al-Salam, and it's called, which means the Peace Brigade. And he controls a big, powerful bloc in Parliament, and he's a kingmaker.
So he may have been, your sense is he may indeed have been involved with the Ministry of Health to kind of bankroll the Mahdi army.
You know, I obviously don't know.
Right, of course. But
for sure that happened. What I could tell you is, you know, just going back to, you know, that 2005 period and being in Iraq, I would go, you know, as a lot of my journalist colleagues and my Iraqi colleagues that I work with, you'd go to the hospitals in Baghdad, and the conditions were extraordinarily austere. And you'd see these relatives of injured and sick people providing everything to their loved ones in the hospital, food, everything. And, you know, they'd need something, a drug, a medicine, and they would have to go to the black market to get the... And this is going from, you know, this period where we've... There should have been a surge, right, of care and quality of care when you're talking about, you know, pre-invasion, a $16 million budget to a $1 billion budget.
Wow, you would think they'd buy a few things for that. One of the plaintiffs in the suit, Amy Nyberger, her 22-year-old brother was killed in a roadside bombing allegedly carried out by the Mahdi army in 2007. Your article includes a powerful quote from her. I'm hoping you might be able to read that quote for listeners, please. It's powerful.
It is, and, you know, it's her, you know, getting to talk to her. She's an amazing person, and this was, if I read the quote, her little brother, she's 14 younger. It wasn't just her little brother. She was like a second mother to this kid. And, you know, she recalled her younger brother as this really funny guy who was quiet but could kill you with, you know, the dry one-liner. And, you know, he was a good friend all, and it's just to this family, they go every year on his birthday in August, and he died days after his 22nd birthday. But they go, and they, you know, and this family goes and remembers and laughs and tries to remember what a great guy he was and not to let that leave them. But yeah, you're right, this quote is amazing. And she said, "I'd always pictured my brother's killers as faceless. I wouldn't have thought U.S. companies would have anything to do with his death. Those funds went directly from those companies to terrorists who had a mission to kill U.S. troops like my brother. They should be held accountable. Companies should know what is done in their name." And that was from Amy Nyberger Miller.
Boy, there's nothing quite like that personal thing, you know, faceless and then realize the American, it's just so hard to believe. It's astounding. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is USA Today journalist Amar Mardani. He's got an article, "Iraq Victims Allege Pharmaceutical Companies' Bribery Led to U.S. Troops' Deaths." As your article points out, Ryan Sparacino, one of the attorneys representing the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, says, "We believe the evidence will show that when Jaish al-Mahdi seized the Iraqi health ministry, the defendants continued paying the same bribes they provided under Saddam, except in far greater amounts." What does that mean as far as its effect on American lives in Iraq? They were paying bribes before to our ally, Saddam.
Going back to the oil for food allegations, you know, that this was something that was going on for, you know, this prior to the army.
Right.
Yeah, you know, this was, there was, you know, you go back pre-Saddam with the scandal that was oil for food. Hundreds of multinational companies were said to, close to $2 billion were funneled into Saddam's regime. And these companies had been, you know, scolded before this. GE had resolved a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act charge brought by the Securities Exchange Commission, dating back to the oil for food scandal, and they paid almost $23 million in fine. And AstraZeneca, AB, their UK affiliate, one of the companies named in the suit, they were cited for having paid at least $162,000 in kickbacks, according to the Volcker Commission that formed to investigate the corruption after the fact. You know, so, you know, I think what the attorneys are saying is this was sort of a continuation and of how business was done in the prior regime.
Right. So
it's just a new player.
So you know you got to pay kickbacks and bribes to get your stuff to the market, and it doesn't matter if our side gets it or the other side gets it. That makes sense. Given the recent revelations that the pharmaceutical industry in America exerts tremendous power over Congress, so much so that they didn't even debate the bill that enabled greater distribution of opioid drugs with virtually no oversight. You know, they basically took any governmental oversight away and just kind of gave carte blanche to the opioid producers, some of these same big companies. Do you think this, I mean, this is speculation. Do you think this suit may add pressure to rein in the immense political power of this industry? Are people in Washington paying attention to this? I would sure hope so.
Well, I think consumers are paying attention to this. And I think, you know, one, you, from a pragmatic standpoint, and I'm not an expert on what's going on with the opioid crisis, but just as a taxpayer, not hanging off the possible ramifications of how you're distributing these drugs, what sort of impacts that they could have on public health, it just doesn't seem like the wisest thing, just from a practical standpoint as a taxpayer. There isn't a lot of public trust right now.
Right.
You're right, and there never really has been in the pharmaceutical or healthcare industry. This doesn't help. And you know, I think these aren't quacks that are bringing this lawsuit. I don't know if you know this lawsuit will go anywhere, but you know, these are some serious law firms that put in thousands of hours in analyzing the transactions. You know, and I think it's also telling. You know, one of the plaintiff's lawyers in this case is David C. Frederick, and this is a guy that represented NFL players and their historic suit against the NFL over brain injuries that resulted in nearly $800 million in settlements for players.
So it's not frivolous.
This shouldn't be underestimated, I don't think.
Interesting. Well, could there be legislative solutions, do you think? Or do they just skirt whatever legislative solutions are already in place? Could Congress, in theory anyway, you know, do something about this, do you think? And what might those solutions look like?
I haven't thought a whole lot about this, but sort of the cynic in me says there already is legislative solutions.
I would think
for what they're alleging happened. If this happened, one, there's the Anti-Terrorism Act. But two, there's just, you know, if this is true, right, there has to be minimum, you know, standards of how you do business.
I'm laughing, but it's sickening. It's macabre. It's just unbelievable. Well, this is very, very interesting and, you know, frightening and just too hard to believe. I just don't know how these, if it's the case, I mean, don't, I mean, these people who head up these pharmaceutical companies, they have families themselves. They must know people who may have, you know, people who have kids in Iraq. And I don't know how they can live with themselves. It just amazes me. As Bob Dylan once said, money doesn't talk, it swears. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Amar Marani. I guess the best way to follow your work, I'm hoping you continue to do your actual investigative journalism. What a concept these days with USA Today. Any other place people should read your stuff, or just go to USA Today?
Yeah, usatoday.com is a great place to find mine and my colleagues' work.
Well, thank you so much for revealing this, and maybe some.
Or if you want to pay the $2 for the print.
Yeah, well.
we'll take that, too.
I'm sure.
Thank you very much for taking the time to let your listeners know about this.
Well, thank you for your investigative work. We try to do the right thing and keep democracy alive. Thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Take care. Running to and fro,
hard working at the mail. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Talking to me, trying to roll me up a creek so you can buy, go and try it, you can pay me next week. Ow! Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to imbibe again. Brown hair, good looking, trying to get me, hook on me to marry, settle down, get a home by the book. Ow! Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to imbibe again. Going to school, no need of me complaining, my health gets so good. Ow! Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to imbibe again. Working in the filling station, too many tasks, wipe the window, check the tire, check the orders, all the gas. Ow! Too much monkey business, too much monkey business. Don't want your botheration, get away, leave me. Where is the democracy? Have we morphed into a complete plutocracy? Is there any way out of it? The economy is improving. The jobless rate is holding at less than 5% officially. But how real is this alleged recovery? Is the problem and the solution really more basic and structural than the current holders of debt will even consider allowing us to look at? Is it time to actually erase debts, yes, erase debts as a way to more effectively restart the economy and create new jobs? Is this all practical? Is there any precedent for something like this? Well, our guest today is Mike Krause, who is founding director of the Public Banking Institute and chair of the Pennsylvania Project and a former officer of the Pennsylvania County and State Government and director of the Pennsylvania, Republican Party. Thanks for being with us, Mike Krause. Please tell us first about the Public Banking Institute and the Pennsylvania Project with which you are involved.
Well, the Public Banking Institute was formed back in 2011 to move forward the idea of public banks as they have had in North Dakota for over 100 years. And the Pennsylvania Project is one of a couple dozen local organizations moving these same activities forward, whether at a state level or at a local level, a county, a city, municipality. Might be interesting how I came to this. My business has been international logistics, and I was in Africa and came back in late 2008 and saw things fall apart and said, geez, what just happened here? I went to find out. That led me to a book by Bill Greider called Secrets of the Temple, and it explained what the Federal Reserve is all about and how our banking system actually works, which is that the Fed is a private corporation owned by the nation's banks, and it works for the banks. And that kind of told me all I needed to know.
Right. Well, one of the biggest attractions that many people found to Ron Paul's candidacy in years past was his call, and it seemed to be his alone, his call to take power away from the privately owned Federal Reserve System and instead democratize it. Now, Hillary Clinton proposed public-private partnerships in which, if I have it right, the public would provide the guarantee to attract private investment. So it seems like we, the people, take the risk while they, the private investment people, reap the profits, while a large portion of the money goes to paying back interest instead of the creation of new public works jobs as advertised. Do I have that right?
But yeah, that's exactly correct. What a public bank does is it keeps your funds locally productive. You use your own funds, pension funds, other investments to capitalize the bank. You put your own deposits, your tax revenues, what have you, in the bank. It functions as a bank, but not a retail bank. It has no infrastructure, no branches, tellers, ATMs, that sort of stuff. It makes them very profitable. Those profits can be returned to the general fund, reinvested in more loans. But in any event, the bank then partners with local banks to get affordable credit into the community, or it can loan directly to municipalities. For example, the Bank of North Dakota is putting 1.5% money out there to school districts to refurbish new schools, add classrooms, add science labs, what have you, instead of going after a bond issue. But whatever interest is paid is captured in your own bank. The alternative, what we're hearing more about as regards infrastructure, are public-private partnerships. And that's a Wall Street special. They use public money to guarantee and leverage private investors, and the private investors then finance, own, and rent back to you what used to be public infrastructure. That's just, that's privatization heaven. And from my point of view, it's largely a scam.
A scam. Well, it is certainly profitable. If you just tuned in, our guest today is Mike Krause, a founding director of the Public Banking Institute, and we're talking about kind of a new idea, and that is to erase debts. Now, how would you define that? We're not talking about, people, individuals borrow money from lending institutions. We're not talking about erase those debts. What are you talking about? And tell us about this article that you wrote on Truthdig about this subject.
Well, what I was getting out of the article is the overarching problem, which is the nation is simply drowning in debt. Governments, students, individuals, businesses are just loaded up with debt.
Yes.
And the interest on that debt. And we're on a treadmill just paying off the interest, and that just sucks money out of the economy and out of your household budget for private and productive purposes. So the major need I see is to pay down, pay off, or get rid of the debt. Now, I'm hardly expert here, but Michael Hudson, who is expert, wrote a book called Killing the Host, and it lays out just how the financial community has been like the third arm of modern economics. We used to think there were workers and there were capitalists.
Right.
But now we have financialists, and they're in the middle of all our transactions, and they're sucking money out of the laborer's pocket and out of the capitalist pocket. So financialization, it's called. Make everything into a deal.
Right.
And leverage money right and left and use debt to get more debt. Just extracts money from your household budget, from your city budget, and from your businesses, for that matter, too.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the attractions about the Bernie Sanders campaign was eliminating students' debts. Students have a lot of debts and very high interest debts. And the power of the financial industry. I think it was Kevin Phillips who for years has been talking about this new twist within our economic system, which is the incredible power of the financial houses, which, as you say, are something really different and unique. And I know Franklin Roosevelt talked about the power of...
Sure, and we have simply, through legislation, tilted the field away from the productive economy to the speculative economy, allowing the big banks to combine their banking and finance industries was like one of the great, really bad decisions of the 20th century. I know after the Depression, Roosevelt and his supporters in Congress, the Glass-Steagall Act, separated out the banks and the finance industries. But the Clinton era, that was legislation was gotten rid of. It was called a great modernization, but it simply allowed the banks then to take depositors' money and use that to underwrite and leverage their bets, their speculation. That's what's underwriting the derivatives market. You know, so right now you see banks like Wells Fargo and Chase and others, they're suddenly interested in more retail customers. You know, come bank with us. Well, they want your deposits to underwrite their gambling, basically.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And those derivatives, which we're underwriting, are like, you know, grown to several hundreds of trillions of dollars.
Mm.
If these bets go sideways, there's not enough money in the FDIC or anywhere in the world to cover them. And I think we're heading for another crash. And what happens is we'll bail in the banks. They'll just seize deposits money, as they did in Cyprus, for example. I think that's what's coming. So one of the needs that public banking meets is to secure your funds away from the risky practices of the Wall Street banks, which have gone unchecked, frankly, over the last 8 years. They've just gotten worse.
Yeah, they have gotten worse, certainly. And, the situation that created the crisis back in 2008, 2009 has only gotten worse, and there's just no checks whatsoever. I mean, we have the Dodd-Frank bill, which doesn't seem to be very much. And again, Bernie Sanders called for a restoration, a modernization of the Glass-Steagall Act, which, as you describe, separated out the financial houses from the banks. Your article in Truthdig offers an alternative, and that is to let the Treasury extend almost zero interest loans to state and local governments to pay off their debts, because states and local governments, of course, borrow money. They issue bonds, they borrow money. And so you're suggesting that the Treasury skips the Federal Reserve, which is there to serve not really the common good, but to serve the investors.
It's important to understand how money is created by the Fed. The Fed doesn't have piles of gold backing its money. That's long gone. The Fed takes the faith and credit of the United States.
Yes.
It uses that to then go to the bond market, where bond sellers sell that faith and credit at interest. They return that money to the Fed, and the Fed gives it to the Treasury. This is insane. We have a middleman. We're paying exorbitant interest rates for the privilege of having our own money. What I'm proposing, and others have proposed, I think, is to bypass the Fed to attack the big macro problem, which is the debt burden. We must do something to erase that debt burden. So, for example, if the Treasury, as did Lincoln, and as Secretary La Hood proposed way back when, simply provided the money directly from the Treasury, our faith and credit to local governments, for example, to pay off debt, well, that means school districts, authorities, towns, cities can pay down their debt immediately. That debt service portion goes out of the local budget and either reduces the tax burden or frees up those taxes for productive purpose in the community. That was one idea. The second is then, of course, to extend $3 trillion of that same almost no-cost credit for infrastructure projects, which would generate an explosion of activity in the public productive sector, in the supply chain of goods and services. It would be extraordinary. And the third idea was to pay down student debt. Right now, the Bank of North Dakota is offering very low-cost loans for every student in the state to consolidate all its more expensive debt, eliminating that debt burden. But we need to get the debt burden off the American people so we can focus our monies on productive purposes. That debt burden is largely artificial. It was created because we have a middleman.
Yes.
The larger banks, the bond system, what have you, in the middle creating our money and then loaning us money at exorbitant rates for public purposes. We don't need them. That's the macro. The micro is then to rehabilitate our banking system and create public banks so that our tax revenues, our local assets, are put to work locally, local direction, local purposes, local control, local profit. That is a way of decentralizing the banking system and strengthening our community banks, local credit unions, the local banking industry as against the Wall Street banks.
Hmm. So I wonder, and more people are doing that, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, and conservatives, they like to, I mean, there's this new sort of ethos of keep your money local. Don't put it in a big bank, you know, the First National Bank, Bank of America, the big banks, and keep it local so that they can lend locally. What happens to these banks now, these for-profit, frankly, banks, and they're making it on a shoestring these days. I mean, I don't know how they're doing it, really. But what happens?
We have a very uneven playing field in the banking industry. The biggest banks just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're squeezing out the local banks. We want to give market share back to the local banks and credit unions and savings and loans, who frankly are, they live in the community. They're related to what's going on. They care. You go to, let's just say, Wells Fargo for a loan. Mm-hmm. Somebody 1,000 miles away makes that decision.
With yes.
Absolutely no connection to your community whatsoever.
I know.
You know, the local officers are just intake people. They push paper, and it goes to a center someplace else. And someone who doesn't know you, can't size you up as a customer, doesn't know about your community, doesn't care about your community, they make the decisions based on their next quarterly statement.
Right.
That's a rotten way to bank. It's great if you're a big bank. It's terrible if you're a community, which needs banking services sized to and built around the needs of the community. That's one thing that public banking does. The whole idea, Bert, is to facilitate and encourage our diversity. You know, going back to de Tocqueville, who observed the tremendous diversity of the American people, we've only gotten more diverse. That diversity is an asset. And if you can enable that asset, then you enable that diversity in the country. So public banking is a way to democratize our banking, but at the same time to enable the diversity of our nation. We think that's a way back to greater productivity.
Seems to make a lot of sense. And again, it is working in North Dakota and other places. But and I thought it was very interesting that the Federal Reserve System is charging us high interest to use our own money. Now, there's nothing, if I understand it correctly, there's nothing stopping the Treasury from creating this new money and bypassing the Federal Reserve and cutting out the bankster middlemen. For their, you know, usurious interest.
No, Lincoln did it with an act of Congress, and it can be done again. The Treasury can be directed to engage in this activity. It used to. It can. Understand, the Congress can do anything it wants.
Yes.
Tomorrow, in a week's time, there could be an amendment to overturn the Citizens United if the Congress wanted to do that.
Right.
And if the Congress wanted to enable Treasury to make these kinds of transactions, it could do it. The power resides in the Congress. They just have to want to do it. And obviously, as most listeners will know, the banking industry, meaning the Wall Street banks, have enormous clout in Washington. We all know
that. Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm not telling anybody anything new here.
Yeah.
So it will require putting people on the spot, that is to say, candidates for Congress, to say, okay, what do you want to do here? We have these problems. Here's one way to fix it. You know, what's your idea? And do you or do you not want to get out from under the debt burden?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people generally understand just how phenomenally indebted we are and why and to whom.
Mm.
We're indebted to a global financial cartel. That's to whom we are indebted. They're sucking money out of the United States of America. They're like a gigantic parasite. It needn't be that way. It didn't used to be that way. It needn't be that way in the future. But it will require citizens to understand the scam going on here, the longest-running con game since the Fed was created, and put an end to the con game, and use our own treasury to fund productive purposes in our own economy. I mean, it can be done. There's no constitutional bar to this.
Mm-hmm.
There's no legal bar to it. It's simply a matter of political will.
And the Federal Reserve System came in the early part of the 20th century. Is that correct?
1913.
And what made it happen? Seems odd.
Well, what made it happen was an enormous lobbying effort. If you read William Grider's Secrets of the Temple, which goes through the history of the Fed, you discover a decades-long campaign to wrest control of the nation's money supply into the hands of the banking elite. It was a long, long campaign. They employed academics. They employed journalists, which we would call lobbyists. They were called flacks. It was a long, long campaign over 2 decades. To persuade the Congress to make this move, and eventually it prevailed. But it was a banking coup, basically, that took unto itself the control over the supply and the cost of the nation's money. This is an old battle. This has been going on for ages. If you read Alan Brown's The Public Bank Solution, you get a history of this ongoing war to wrest control of the wealth of nations, including our nation, Great Britain, others, into the hands of a financial elite. Somewhere, there's a marvelous quote of one of the Rothschilds back in 1820, 40, somewhere like that. And he said, Give me control of a nation's money, and I care not who makes the laws.
Mm-hmm.
It's an enormous power, and we've given it to a global cartel.
Wow, that's why Franklin Roosevelt said that the power of organized money is as dangerous as government by organized mob. Very, very similar.
Well, that you just said something interesting. If you read Matt Taibbi and other folks from Rolling Stone, he compares banking to a mob racket. That's just organized crime, basically, which goes unpunished, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the little signs you get of how things actually are is that, you know, after all this criminal activity, huge investigations, massive fraud, banks got fined for felonies. Banks got paid, had to pay, you know, billions of dollars of fines, but no banker went to jail.
Mm-hmm.
So great. What a wonderful racket. But you know, the Fed's going to cover for us. And that's what happened.
My goodness. I guess in Iceland they did it pretty differently recently. They actually put some of those guys in jail. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Live, our guest on this half hour is Mike Krause. He's founding director of the Public Banking Institute and chair of the Pennsylvania Project. And we're talking about eliminating debt, erasing the debt, doing it as it seems like our founders intended us to use our own money and have some democratic process in it. And talking about history, tell us about the precedent set by Abraham Lincoln after the war against the South. What did he do that is sort of...
Well, during the war, Lincoln had the same problem. He was going to the banks in New York, or the government was, to finance the war. And they wanted, you know, 30% interest, that sort of stuff. And he said, well, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
And he passed the law in the Congress. And that led to, over time, the creation of $450 million of treasury bills called greenbacks that were green. And that was put into the economy to pay the war, pay soldiers' salaries, and then later for an economic expansion that followed, which was substantial. He simply cut out the middleman. Of course, after Lincoln died, that law was overturned, and we went back to bank financing. But that $450 million then, in today's dollars, is about $6.3 billion. So this can be done. The numbers we're proposing, $3 trillion, let me say that again, $450 million is $6.3 trillion in today's dollars.
Yeah, real dollars.
So clearly, the Treasury has the capacity to help state, local government, school districts pay off their debt. Clearly, it has the capacity to fund cities and counties and states in infrastructure projects. Clearly, it has the capacity to eliminate student debt, or at least to refinance it at much lower terms. And easing that debt burden then frees up what we're paying in interest to go into our own communities, our own families, our own businesses. It is potentially a revolutionary.
And I wonder if any talk about revolutionary, this was a term that Bernie Sanders used quite a bit. Did he have anything like this in his proposals? And are there any candidates now talking about anything like this?
Are there any candidates talking about this?
Yeah, I mean...
Yes, of course. There are people running for state treasurer, state representative, state senator, members of Congress, all over the nation. Tim Canova, by the way, who's opposing Debbie Wasserman Schultz down there in Florida in that primary, is an advocate of public banking and the Federal Reserve Reform. Fellow running for state treasurer out in Washington. You have folks in New Hampshire. I think there's State Rep. Valerie Frazier, who's an advocate of public banking. There's a city councilman and also a state rep, Chris Herbert, who's supportive of this. We have mayors, city council members, ideas, bills moving forward in city councils and state legislatures. So the answer is yes. We're building a national caucus of advocates of public banking, but trying to put them in the context of finance reform and control of our money and democratizing it again.
Yes.
So the answer is yes. There are people who have highlighted this message in their campaigns running for office right now at Congress, state rep, city council, state treasurer, across the nation, coast to coast.
And when there are usurious interest rates paid by different countries around the world, developing nations, gang that lends money to them, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, haven't they refinanced the debt? Have they ever forgiven a debt of a country and just erased the debt? And
almost never.
Yeah,
what the World Bank and IMF do is they simply refinance. and they pile more debt upon more debt. That's how they ran Greece under the ground.
Yeah.
They just kept extending more and more credit. With, by the way, with a risk premium, this is a sweetheart deal. You know, you're going to loan to Greece, or you're going to loan to Detroit or Puerto Rico, for example, and you say, gee, that's risky. So instead of 8%, I'll make it 13% or 11%. I want a risk premium. Well, then they go under, and the bondholders will say, we want all our money back, including the risk premium.
Mm-hmm.
So we took the risk, and there is a risk, but we want to be paid for it anyway. And that's just typical of what goes on in global finance.
That would be make any mafia person envious, I imagine.
Yeah, it's as Matt Taibbi said, it's basically a mob, it's a racket.
Yeah,
it's a first class racket. It's a good racket, and they've been getting away with it for decades. And we need to put an end to the racket.
I got to ask: Did Franklin Roosevelt, did he go through the Federal Reserve, which was in existence at the time, or did he go straight?
FDR dealt with the Fed. It was there, but he had a sharp Fed chairman, Marion X, who understood all this, who knew how the money was created. But Roosevelt went around them. He had a Reconstruction Finance Corporation that grew to be the largest company in the United States, financing much of the New Deal Reconstruction. And he bypassed the Fed in that regard. It went to the Congress. And Congress saw this was a great deal, all these projects. I mean, you know, the finance agency employed, what, 8 million people. It built, I don't know, the San Antonio Riverwalk, Pennsylvania Turnpike, LaGuardia Airport, Dam, you know.
National parks.
Projects all across the nation. It was quite successful.
Yes.
And it was run independent of the Fed. It was a private corporation that Roosevelt set up.
Hmm. But they didn't make money back, did they? I mean, they didn't charge interest, did they?
Well, it stayed in business into the 50s. When the banks realized that they were being cut out of the financing of all these projects, and they quietly killed it in, I think, 1952. It was, at its time, the biggest corporation in the United States by asset and by dollar amount, and it was a government corporation. And it put public money to public purposes and cut out the finance guys in the middle. And so it was an adjustment to the capitalist system, so we actually got back to workers and capitalists and not so many financialists. Now that's been totally wiped away. And the financial sector is bigger than the labor sector. It's bigger than the capital sector. It dominates the economy. And it's grown to ever and ever larger, and it's just sucking money out of the American body public.
And Edgar Bronfman called interest the greatest invention of the world. And we have this capitalist system, which depends on what Edgar Bronfman loves so much, interest. Wouldn't what's being proposed here threaten capitalism itself?
Well, we are hung up on definitions and slogans, frankly. Late 20th century capitalism has evolved into ever larger and larger global monopolies. At some point in time, capitalists survived by getting rid of competition. And so what you see globally is this ever larger tend towards global monopolies. That's what the Trans-Pacific Trade Pact is all about.
Yeah.
It's about globalizing certain industries, creating huge monopolies, factoring out competition, and rigging the marketplace. So you know, 20th century capitalism is basically dying. Maybe of its own success, maybe not, but it's certainly dying into global monopolies, which is the last latent malignant form of capitalism. And it's, you know, it's either going to rule the world. And we'll become serfs of a debt plantation, as it were, and change that. So we're arguing for change. At the macro level, we want to see the government directly fund its own activities and bypass the middlemen who charge interest to give us that money. At the micro level, we want to see public banks at the state, local, county level using local resources to capitalize the bank and putting local deposits in that bank and putting it to work for locally directed purposes. That would be a great democratization of our economy. You know, my degree is not in economics. I'm learning this as I go. It's in government. But what I know from my government studies is that in all societies, almost every time, political power is a function of wealth. And when wealth is concentrated, then so too is political power.
Yeah.
If you deconcentrate the wealth, you will, of necessity, and eventually deconcentrate the political power. So when I look at the United States today, I say, well, political reform would be great, but that's not the first purpose. You must reform the economy, and then the political reform will follow as a matter of course. Decentralize the money, and you will decentralize the power. So that's why I've, although I'm a government major, I'm these days focused on banking and economics, because I think I understand the way the game is played.
Well, that makes it pretty clear. I mean, and the title of the show is Keeping Democracy Alive. It is one heavy lift. We all need to be part of it. And you know, I prefer democracy to plutocracy. I really do. And I think you do, too, Mike Krause. Thanks so much for being with us. Very informative. How can people get in touch with you? You know, what website?
Well, it's my pleasure. And let me just ask folks who are interested to go to one of two websites. We have the Pennsylvania Project, www.publicbankingpa.org. And the national organization, www.publicbankinginstitute.org, there is a wealth of information there, papers, resources, studies, current events. It's a good education.
We will get there. I'm convinced of it. Thank you again so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
National loan sharks, backed by the guns of market-hungry military profiteers, whose word is a swamp and whose brow is smeared with the blood of the poor. Who rob life of its quality, who render rage a necessity, by turning countries into labor camps, modern slavers and dragons, champions of freedom. And cynical instrument who makes the gun into a sacrament, the only response to the deification of tyranny by so-called developed nations, idolatry of ideology. North, south, east, west, kill the best and buy the rest. It's just spend a buck to make a buck. You don't really give a flying fuck about the people.